Audible Studios presents Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff, written by Pappy Pariah, read by Sean Penn, with Francis McDormand, Layla George, and Ari Fliakos.
Part 1. One day I will find the right words, and they will be simple. Jack Kerouac, The Dharma Bums.
Woodview County, September 15th, 2001.
911, what's your emergency?
My name is Helen Mayo. I live at 1531 Sweet Dog Lane. I don't know if I have an emergency, but I have a new neighbor. And I'm sorry if I just think he's behaving strangely, and perhaps the police would like to take a look, or maybe go and have a chat with him.
Can you describe the strange behavior, please, ma'am?
Well, it seems he's wrapping some kind of insulated wire around his house and his tool shed. I don't know his address, but it's just two doors from me, and I can see him from my kitchen window. Well, I don't know. I just think the police should be involved.
Okay, ma'am. Thank you for your call. We'll go ahead and have one of our patrols take a look.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sheriff's Blotter, Woodview County, December 7th, 2003. Several residents of Upper Sweet Dog Lane reporting overgrowth of a neighbor's lawn. A 30-day notice has been posted. Sheriff's Blotter, Woodview County, December 29th, 2003. Neighbors complain of excessive lawnmower noise, 3 a.m. When patrol arrived, all was quiet, scent of fresh-cut grass permeating the air. Woodview County, December 1st, 2004.
911, what's your emergency?
Yes, this is Helen Mayo on Sweet Dog Lane.
Yes, Miss Mayo, what's your emergency?
Well, I just don't know. But that neighbor, you know, I've called you about him before. He's cut his hair in a rather disturbing way.
He's cut his hair, Miss Mayo?
Yes, but I wouldn't bother you with a fashion, you know.
No, I'm sure you wouldn't, ma'am. But you have to help me understand your concern.
Well, it's something like a Nazi or a woodshop teacher. And as you know, I am not alone on this street in my concerns about him. And it's my understanding that with all the calls and complaints, the police in this town have never actually had a conversation with him. And don't you think that with all the strange behavior and the haircuts and all of that, you know what I mean? He doesn't look Arab. He's a white man. But somebody should talk to him.
Sheriff's Blotter, Woodview County, December 23rd, 2003. Resident at 1528 Sweet Dog Lane was cited for illegal posting of a sign reading, International airports boast morbid male mannequins at duty free. At 10 p.m., a patrol car, dispatched to the address, served the citation to the location. Resident was not at home. The citation was left at resident's door. Sheriff's Blotter, Woodview County, December 24, 2003. At 6:34 a.m., Woodview County Sheriff's Office was contacted by resident. And this is that recorded conversation.
Woodview Sheriff's Office?
Yes, ma'am. I'm resident 1528 Sweet Dog Lane and in receipt of a citation for illegal posting. To whom it may concern, it wasn't my sign.
Given only circumstantial connection, the citation was disposed of.
All aboard. September 2016.
Cactus Fields. A low-cost home for assisted senior living stands like a brick with covered windows, isolated against the desert. And there they were, the brandless beasts of yesteryear. Moist, sagging eyes, illuminated by the occasional strobe of a passing car on the interstate. Behind the windows of the beige stucco building were brown weeds burst through fissures in the dilapidated, rarely visited parking lot. Eight of them had been awakened by the power cut. They sit side by side in plastic chairs, the portraiture of their faces falling in and out of light and shadow. Blotchy, colorless skin, a reckoning of their uselessness, where branding is being. Their static fear too pathetic to shiver. Then mercy comes by malevolent mallet. Pop, pop, pop. Three down. The elderly are being executed. Gloved hands reconnect wires in a power box out back. Eight have become the five whose day will come. A Pontiac ignites its engine, rolls over the fissures of weed onto the interstate, and under its driver's breath,
"It wasn't me."
Gloves off, he switches on a CD. As the Pontiac drifts into the American nightscape, so does Phil Oakes' voice, singing, This country is too young to die. Even treason might be worth a try. I declare the war is over.
Station 1. Recollections of a Teenaged Carney.
Meet Bob Honey, the resident of 1528 Sweet Dog Lane, who most often speaks of himself in the third person. A former fixed-wing shuttle operator, barge fireworks display purveyor, and one who made a killing in the septic tank pumping industry by focusing on an exclusive clientele of Jehovah's Witnesses. Bob regretted never attaining a real estate license or exploiting his imagined tagline, "Buy a honey of a property." He thought it might even make a good t-shirt slogan dressed over his honey bear heft, had his dependence on pocket protectors not likely overcomplicated the cut. Now in his mid-50s, Bob is a solitary man. Although he lives alone, it is Bob's perception that he wakes to his ex-wife and to their speechless marriage each morning. Every night, with a voice as if affected by peanut butter permanently embedded in the roof of his mouth, he goes to bed quoting,
ABC, CBA, ABC, CBA.
The alphabet's first three, forward, then back, in lieu of sheep. This is typically followed by a dreamless sleep. Come morning, there, as always, she is, his silent ex-wife. Her chub and red hair, a small booger flopping, flittering, and sputtering like a carburetor valve backward and forward in her nostril with every breath in and out. It was impossible for Bob, waking up all those mornings to her speechless misandry and fraudulently feminist superhero dreams. Impossible for him not to consider ligature strangulation. And when he did approach that consideration, and only then, did he find himself liberated to move away from the empty bed. Bob did know how to begin a day. One foot, then the other, into a pair of pants and a freshly laundered shirt. Open the gun safe in his garage and transfer the mallet from the Clorox bucket to the water bucket. Lock the safe, then whip up some fluffy eggs with cream. Cook them in crisp bacon grease and get on with it. Yes, Bob knew how to get up in the morning and just do stuff. The ex-wife his imagination committed to loathing each morning had actually left many years before, but never went far away. With money won in their divorce, she'd purchased an ice cream truck, the kind that would cruise neighborhoods slowly seeking out children with circus music broadcast through its PA system, that alternately haunting and annoying sound that conjured clowns, midgets, and stuffed animals. She'd taken up with a man, strangely, buying into Bob's adopted neighborhood just blocks away, and it was only the upper end of Sweet Dog Lane that she chose not to cruise in avoidance of an encounter with Bob. Nonetheless, it was as though he could not get away from her. The acoustics of Woodview were such that after school hours in winter, and seemingly every day through the summer, she would sell her frozen wares, the distant circus music drifting tortuously into Bob's ears. It hadn't always been that way. As a boy in the San Joaquin Valley of the 1960s and early 70s, Bob rode a red Schwinn Stingray and would often use it to chase down an ice cream truck, not unlike his ex-wife's, buy the strawberry shortcake popsicle, then join the pack or ride alone throughout the neighborhood as a youngster. Sometimes he'd go to the river basin and throw bombs off the bridge. Molotov cocktails were preferable if you could get your targeting right. If you hit the paved riverbed close enough to the water's edge, the high-octane fuel would even set the river on fire. To finance his fever for flame, Bob took employment as a kid carny in local fairs and carnivals. It was in this occupation where he developed a flair for the mallet. Bob barked for the high striker, what is often called the strongman's game. It consists of a heavy base and a long vertical tower. A groove runs along the tower's length. A puck sits at the tower bottom beneath a lever, and at the top of the tower, a bell. If one strikes the lever with the mallet asserting enough force, it will send the puck careening upward along the grooves to ring the bell. On Bob's, the tower ran the length of a 15-foot-high cutout dragon, and the puck was heavy. Bob honed his own skills off hours. While strength alone may be enough to ring the bell, it was really in finding a sweet spot of impact, where a mallet could be most malevolent. and the kid Carney barked.
Be you knave or knight, come one, come all, come slay the dragon.
In that childhood, he revered the Anarchist Cookbook, a 1971 published Bible of bomb-making and mayhem for the misguided. And it did. It guided Bob to the heart of all good things. Potassium nitrate, what ranchers call saltpeter. They mix it into the salt lick of horses when they don't want them to breed. Saltpeter is a proper devil. If you eat it, your wee-wee won't work. But mix it up with a bit of sulfur and charcoal, or maybe a little sugar, and you have yourself the makings of a pretty pipe bomb. Magnesium ribbon, ignited by the flame tip of a Bunsen burner, illuminated brightly for a child's eyes. But more impressive was to cut a snip of it off, throw it in a test tube of hydrochloric acid, cover the mouth of the tube with a balloon, and watch it expand with pure hydrogen gas. Then tie the fucker off, get a long stick with a lit matchstick tied to the end of it, contact and ignite it into the fireball that hearkened Hiroshima. With these tools, and a Christmas-gifted parabolic microphone, could any hot-blooded young American certainly save the world? Charlie Manson's world. The Viet Cong's world. The Zodiac Killer's world. The media's world. Bob knew the media had limited success in telling the country how to think, but was exemplary at telling it what to think about, to discuss, and to value, if the hope of an individual is to merge with the common interests of the societally engaged. Hitler knew this too. The Bilderbergs discuss and influence it ad nauseam. Prince Bernhard was a Nazi, but Bob? No such luck. Essentially a child bomber who dreamt of being a geologist, Bob initially concerned himself only with the shine his lapidary equipment and tumbler could bring to nearly any found stone. But upon some reflection, it occurred to him that within the dust, bones, and petrification of sedimentary rock was held an egoless and truthful history. While Bob had his own wants and needs within a lifetime, when he didn't get what he wanted, he always found something to do, and carried that into his adult years. Though Bob engaged in many spontaneous activities, his general view of himself, of his life, was as the proverbial dog to Groundhog Day's attribution. Where others may dream activities such as Bob's, we'll get into these activities later, in Bob's living of them, did he find himself dreamless in sleep. It wasn't a very different experience, he thought, than the hordes who so alienated him may themselves inhabit in consciousness. Bob rarely received callers, though once in a very long while might someone invade Bob's solitude. Typically, these instances were self-regulated to afternoons in sunny weather. Perhaps Bob's house, despite its common, single-leveled smallness, presented itself an oddity or an otherwise fright to approach for one not diligently disposed to a sunny state of mind. Still, when a knock came at the door, it came timidly. And it was on just such a day, following just such a knock, when Bob first opened the door to the portly man with thinning hair, roughly Bob's age, if not a few years his senior. The two men shared blank stares for many seconds of silence. Strangers on pause, without pomp nor circumstance, yet as if awaiting the tines, tuning forks, and violet rays of Tesla's coil. Might this, their meeting on this day, be that resonant transformer? Then, Spurley Cultier, you Bob Honey? Bob nodded. I knew by your address, Spurley said. Bob nodded again. May I come in? Asked Spurley. Bob nodded a third time. Then, in a most rare and personally alien impulse, did he allow the portly Cultier into his home, gesturing him toward the small living room. Cultier took up the table and chair, and Bob sat centered on the couch.
French?
Bob asked.
American, said Cultier. What do you do, Bob?
Bob was puzzled. Then,
just stuff. What do you do, Spurley?
I'm an investigative journalist, Bob. When Bob would chuckle, it was an awkward, guttural sound, audible though he never intended it so. Spurley asked, do you think that's funny? Bob shook his head, then said,
so you ask people questions?
Yes, Bob.
And they give you answers?
Sometimes they do, Bob.
Do you believe their answers?
Bob asked. Sometimes I do, Bob.
Not me,
Bob said.
I don't believe anybody's answers.
Can I believe yours, Bob?
No, I don't ever really tell the truth much. I wonder sometimes if the truth might be more habit than virtue.
Yes, said Spurley. The practice of honesty has a gray hue.
So, why do you ask questions, Spurley?
Good question, Bob. It's a heck of a good question indeed. I'm glad you asked me that question. I'm going to go ahead and try to answer it, Bob. Your neighbors, I noticed on the sheriff's blotter, had made several, interesting observations and inquiries of you to the local sheriff's office over these many years. Bob nodded. Are you aware of that? Asked Spurley. Bob's toolbox never included feigned puzzlement.
The optics are suspicious,
he offered. That's what it is, Bob. The optics. You're dead on. The optics, said Spurley.
Spurley, why do you pronounce your name Colt E.A., if you're American?
How would you have me pronounce it, Bob? Blushing, Bob said.
It's none of my business.
Let me ask you, Bob, would you be amenable to my visiting again? Bob thought long and hard. Something seemingly ancient inside him was primally peeking out and noting a turning point in his existence of exile. In systems theory, one small thing leads to another. The water, the plants, the photosynthesis, and the eventuality of bloom. In punctuated equilibrium, it's like an earthquake and suddenly everything changes. If one is not adaptable, catastrophic systems failure will occur. Bob began to recognize the punctuated equilibrium being visited upon him and would not allow a catastrophic systems failure. Spurley, it seemed, might be the right vessel at the right time, and Bob would seek to adapt. Perhaps we could meet out, suggested Spurley. McDonald's on Hedge Point Road? No arches for Bob.
I'd prefer my home.
Fair enough, said Spurley, rising from his chair. Shall we say Wednesday, 4 p.m.?
I'm sometimes not here,
Bob said in an effort at fair warning. Yes, well, we'll talk about that, Spurley said as he moved to the door. I'll be by Wednesday at 4, and if you're here, we can talk a bit more. Bob nodded but never rose from the couch. Spurley let himself out. Bob watched through the picture window as Spurley took note of the Pontiac in the driveway, then himself left in a Prius, the silent type. For the next several hours, Bob would not move a muscle, but he could feel an unusual pounding in his heart. He could feel his breath slightly shorten. It was on that couch where Bob felt safest, almost embraced. And in his stillness there, on that day and into the evening, returned his visions of Annie. Ah, that girl, that shining young face. With few exceptions, explosions among them, Bob had always experienced life as an aspiration to dullness with dignity, absent as much deceit as possible. He had a heightened intolerance of advertising. Annie had been that one brief break in the weather. She advertised, Bob thought, yet without falseness, or if so, less falseness than others, and after all, Bob was not prone to question himself in that single matter of the heart that Annie reflected. The waking rarity that Annie had become to him. They'd met on a park bench one day during Bob's surveillance of elderly lawn bowlers.
Hello,
said a charming, cross-Atlantic voice. One look at her, standing above him in that park, and Bob felt a relaxing of his joints. She may have been young. She may even have been too young. But Bob never bothered himself with those distinctions. And besides, she had blonde, not red hair. Effervescence lived in her every expression. They sat and talked, or rather she did. They had a brief love affair, or rather he did. What a magical vagina, Bob thought after exploring it for hours. Bob had never considered himself an aesthete, but he did look long and hard for things that might disturb him. And it was in the absence of disturbance that beauty was defined for Bob. It had begun that very day, after strolling to his house from the park. They sat silently on his comfort couch. A look between them, and off went the clothing, and on came their shorthand. It was in the aftermath of sex when he said,
Good vagina. Maybe more Vietnam.
More Vietnam,
Is it a bit urban? You're looking for some jungle?
Bob nodded.
Okay, I'll let it go for next time.
Okay, said Bob. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And so went their discussion and his continued examination of her body. And so went on and off the romance for a brief few months, until off she went and forever away, but not without the occasional text messages from her travels, or perhaps one image from a select telephonic photo diary, 11 pictures to date. The last one had been from her chronicles of a girl's trip to Las Vegas. It was an unvarnished snap of a 12-inch and girthy black dildo, which appeared to have been discarded on a Vegas sidewalk beside some greenery. It came with a simple note. Greetings from Las Vegas. I'm with the girls. Bob found form in the way Annie giggled at his apparent brooding and solitude. In her generation's world, had Adderall and advertisers' chickens come home to roost? Bob felt from feline millennials the transmissions of Instagrams blazingly blitzing from all directions, as if the sensation of Roman arrows careening through his skull. No one spoke to anyone, and when they did, it was more about those anthropomorphic arrows than it was the natural air of an organically human traverse. That air, that life, again so unceremoniously sidelined by a generation bent to uninvent the wheel of love and oblivious to the control computations of surveillance. He'd try thinking of chocolate bananas, cotton candy, and chugging trains to ward off consciousness of their detachment, yet to no avail. Whenever he felt these collisions of incubus and succubus, he punched a code and drew deployment, dodging the ambush of innocence astray, evading viagratic assaults on virtual vaginas, and quaking the elderly in all corners. Pop goes the weasel. Bob's mallet would speak. He knew his destiny's turn. She had taught him well with her smile, her eyes, and the little thoughts she thought of him when she thought them. Ah, that girl and the glistening between her legs, schooling him in the forward movement of her and her contemporaries, a momentum undeniable as gravity, as irrefutable as the generational inversion of human expertise she so embodied. In Bob's defiance had he found himself, against advisement, awaiting things that had already passed, leaving him to face that harshest prospect of all, that he must give up on the only thing he really wanted. He'd hungered to tell her all his secrets, but became one of them instead. Heartbreaking, frustrating, but at times, so very sweet. He knew a likely pipe dream better than most. She had never let him on, and sure enough, his maturity of years alone had given him a huge head start in his feelings for her, and never expected her to catch up on her own. With any encouragement, he'd have backtracked till he had her hand in his, had a present hand in his past. He imagined that often, being encouraged, her hand in his, as the ever-present image of her knowing brown eyes softly floated before him. He had dropped her off at departures that last time. Then the aircraft engines revved, wheels left ground, and his world's atmosphere became host to a new variant of air, absent the sweetness of her breath, yet mercifully absent those arrows of post-adolescence careening through lower altitudes. He took comfort that her smile, like heaven's shield, would keep her safe, warm, and wild. Branding is being. Branding is being. The code of modern binary existentialism. If only he'd known back then. But instead, Bob had spent such a significant several years in the septic specialization industry, one so full of pathogens, worms, and protozoa, that if left untreated, would come to represent a present public health crisis. It is not a business so easy in which to get one's footing. The very soil upon which one stands contains 40 million bacterial cells per single gram of soil. It is jam-packed with microbes that, if used properly, will break down the pathogens. Now, while sanitarians decide design, Bob found his forte in pumping and baffle replacements. Despite a deep understanding of depth soil's vertical separation to the bottom of the drain field, then to the top of the groundwater's restrictive layer, and also a relatively acute sense of sludge layers leading to the scum layers due to the effluents leaked into the leach fields, there was one sentence from a Sunday sermon that had stuck out to Bob from the basic precepts of Jehovah's Witnesses. Belief and practice from the raw material. That phrase had summoned in him the singular entrepreneurial interest in isolating those churchers' investment in his septic services as a pumper. This had kept him far from the branding crowd and from the technological advances of social indulgence, so circuitously enslaving those more supple of skin. Bob kept his skin supple on the work site with latex gloves. His knowledge and experience, secured through a surgical sensibility towards his vocation, complemented Bob's skill set-specific capacity for reverse engineering. Almost without effort could Bob synthesize civilian architecture. By identifying where urine and feces fell, and its storage system size, design, and placement, especially where gravity systems are employed, could he mentally X-ray the interior of a building simply by observing its exterior? This had application in human systems analysis as well. It wasn't brandable, but it was Bob. Bob Honey, a man with a mission in mind.
Station 2, the Scottsdale Program.
Several days had passed since Burley Coltier's visit. Bob caught himself standing by his posted kitchen calendar, staring at the days with distraction. He saw that this was Tuesday, 1600 hours, and on the following day, Spurley Coltier intended a second visit at about this time. Bob had noted it on the calendar, spelled Coltier, Colt-E-A. He checked his watch and stepped to the refrigerator, opened it, pulled a fresh packet of hot dogs out, exited the house, got into his Pontiac, rocked the mirror dice, and hit the road. With Annie's Chronicles of Vegas parading in his mind, Bob drove across the Mojave in search of any and all intimacies of anatomacies. From those 11 stations of love, he'd start with that large black dildo ditched streetside all those months earlier. Armed with Oscar Mayer wieners, white birthday candles, and an X-Acto knife, he was only 3 hours on the hunt in Vegas when he sniffed it out from under a hedge, using Annie's sidewalk photo for reference. He removed one of his socks, using it as a glove, and picked up the big black unit. He then drove 40 clicks into the Moapa Indian Reservation to memorialize his find in ceremony. At midnight on the reservation, Bob was surrounded by desert and stars. He clawed out a hole in the ground and stuck the dildo's base into it. With the X-Acto knife, he sliced a small sliver pee hole into its tippy top, then inserted the bottom of a white birthday candle into the pee hole, lit it, and slightly adjusted its direction toward the North Star. The silicone schlong burned fast and hot. He didn't even get the first hot dog out of the package, much less cook it, before the whole cock melted like the Wicked Witch from Prick to Puddle. Defeated, Bob looked toward space and began to sing.
Oh, I wish I were...
Branding is being. I see you're unshaven, Bob. You look a little tired, a bit black-circled. May I ask what you've been doing with yourself? Spurley Coltier once again sat in Bob's living room at the table end chair with Bob's center couch. Bob was becoming suspicious of Coltier. Perhaps old Spurley was a spy. Bob often thought how consistently the intelligence community lacked intelligence. They spelled data with an 8 and call it code. It occurred to him that there was nothing covert about a man with a knife collection. They all seemed to have exotic knife collections. Bob inquired.
Knives?
Knives? Asked Spurley.
A knife collection, do you have one?
Spurley's smile went squirrely. I'm an investigative journalist, Bob.
That's right, Bob said. You ask questions. I think if questions are asked of politicians, they should be regarding any acts of cruelty upon animals in their youth. The problem is...
They would lie, Spurley interjected.
This seems to me the problem, said Bob
as he excused himself to the kitchen, poured himself a glass of water, and added a maraschino cherry. From where he stood, he could see that Spurley had put on a pair of cheaters and was scribbling several notes on a pad. Bob considered glasses a terrific invention. It's a wonder one can wear something on their face with such negligible discomfort or distraction. Bob called to him.
Water and a maraschino cherry?
Spurley nodded and Bob poured him a glass, popping a cherry into it. If it's all right with you, Bob, Spurley said, let's discuss a few knowns. You know, known knowns. I've been taking great interest in you of late. Bob nodded. Looks like he spent some time in the Middle East, what was it, a few short weeks before Hussein was captured. Interesting travels, Bob. Bob had traveled to Baghdad during the holiday season of 2003 to investigate sewer options. If he could get an exclusive with the new Shia-backed power base, he might package a turnkey operation from septic tank installation to pumping. This had projections far exceeding his monopoly on the Jehovah's Witnesses in the 80s. He checked into the Rose Petal Hotel behind barricades, blast walls, and a barbed wire entrance, but well outside the green zone. He was to meet with ministers and black marketeers serving under the auspices of Mahmoud Chalabi, El Jefe of the Iraqi National Congress. Chalabi, a U.S. seducer, pawn, and all-around purveyor of bad science. On the night arranged, he hotwired a sitting taxi, but ran out of gas on his way to the INC compound in the Mansour district. He began to walk along Haifa Street, where he was molested by a team of rogue Indig military contractors, moonlighting Kurds, he called them. After they'd gone through his pockets and waistband and scanned the under chassis of the taxi with a bomb mirror, they caught Bob's mallet shoulder-holstered and found it a curious mechanism. Bob refused its seizure, which led the Arabic monolinguists to radio a translator. That's when the New Guineans arrived. After being convinced he meant no harm to any but the old, this perked their decorative ears and Bob made quick comrades of the boys from Papua. It was they who conceded the issue of elderly, handed Bob a code, and would henceforth finance his own moonlight mission as an operator for the Scottsdale program. The drive back through Anbar province in 2003 would teach Bob a lesson in fuel economy, but more on that later.
The trip related to septic tanks, Bob said. Honey, Inc.
Honey, Inc., asked Spurley.
Yes, said Bob, with a C, Inc., Incorporated.
Spurley scribbled a note. I feel like we're getting to the meat and potatoes here, Bob.
You're hungry? Said Bob.
The meat and potatoes. The meat and potatoes. You're talking to me about your business.
It's my business.
I understand you feel that way, Bob. But with this many complaints, do you know Helen Mayo? Neighbor of yours?
I know the floor plan of her house and that her fear of USOs had led her to flee a beach community in the 60s.
USOs. Unidentified Submerged Objects.
Spurley nodded. Ah. Bob nodded. Interesting. You know, she watches your place quite a bit. She's got you leaving at all kinds of funny hours and often for long periods of time.
Well, the house needs airing out, Bob said. Sometimes a place can get stale, harboring the body of a man.
The body of a man, Bob?
Mind, Spurley. Sometimes the house wants its space.
Maybe you keep a diary, Bob. Bob shook his head. Maybe you keep one somewhere, huh, Bob?
Do you write nice things about people, Spurley? Or mean things?
Spurley seemed caught off guard by this question. As he appeared to search for a sensible response, Bob interrupted his silence.
I'm not having fun, Spurley. The house and I need a little space.
Understood, Bob. A man should never overstay his welcome.
Thank you, Spurley,
Bob said. You're welcome, Bob. I'll be checking back in with you. Spurley chugged his glass of water, leaving the cherry at the bottom. I'm going to leave you the cherry, Bob. You might need it. Bob nodded. Spurley went out the door, cruised the Pontiac, and crept silently away in his Prius. Bob's cell phone suddenly rang out Bread's Make It With You. He pulled the phone from his back pocket and accepted the call. Three beeps from the other end. Then Bob responded, pressing a three-digit code. Two beeps followed by a four-digit code. Onto his display, Thousand Oaks Elderly Care Park, 205 Gallivant Road, Thousand Oaks, 96789. Bob entered his garage, double-locked its doors from the inside, opened his safe, and removed the mallet from the water can heavy with moisture. He towel-dried it, holstered it, closed the safe, and re-entered the house. He shit-showered and shaved and put on some khaki pants, a laundered shirt, and an old pair of Wallabies. When Wallaby hit Pontiac's accelerator, the Pontiac set its course for Thousand Oaks. In the common room of the Thousand Oaks Elderly Care Park, the Fridays at Four Aerobics Club was being led by a 5'4", 78-year-old woman in a pink ballet tutu, dark green stockings, and runners. Bob had a clean line on them from his position between the golf course and the croquet lawn. It was common for Bob during the observation phase to muse on the company's selection process. In this case, certainly aerobics may itself be a brand, but the tutu individualism of its instructor might as well associate her with said brand. But Bob had spent enough time, in fact thousands of hours, studying the animations of double rod pendulums, and in their aspiration to claim aerobic exercise, were they only cluttering the world further with chaos physics.
Double rod pendulums, a physical system exhibiting rich dynamic behavior, strong insensitivity to initial conditions.
This is the thing about brands and beauty. They cannot be randomly claimed. They demand polish and a system of greed valuation that would allow its practitioners to bring society a continuing sense of fraudulent comfort. Out there in Thousand Oaks, if there was any design at all to the psychology of its residents, it was that these useless ones encourage their circulatory systems that it may prolong their life and comfort. Useless, Bob thought. Pathetic. A holdout in avoidance of the inevitable. True claims. False world. Awkward and inconvenient. Red lipstick had no place in exercise, and 2 full feet above the waistline of the tutu, her crinkled lipstick lips, her sun-spotted face, her overjoyously little twinkling eyes. He knew how she saw herself, a pop granny, and thought, have I got a pop for her? When class broke, Bob wheeled the Pontiac away and found a local market where the purveyor made sandwiches from day-old bread. He asked the bread to be toasted and bacon and lettuce both crisp, 1 slice of tomato and plenty of mayo to nullify the tomato's acidic effect. BLT is best. Outside the market, Bob sat and watched the sunset, and inside the car he put on a pair of janitor's overalls, the mallet holstered inside it beneath his armpit. When night fell, he walked the quarter mile back to the elderly home. Along the way, he picked up bottle caps, noticed cigarette butts, and the smoggy smell in the night air's humidity. It brought him back to the days of riding his red Schwinn after bombing the river. It was a happy feeling, nostalgic. With the tutu on her nightstand, the aerobics instructor glossed her washed face with Nivea cream, her failing eyes unable to note the puddles of that white cream unabsorbed that remained hiding in the troughs and crinkles of sun and age-ravaged skin. God's portrait of entropy. She put on her nightwear, got into her little childlike bed, and set off to sleep with dreams of Cuban barboys. The janitor paid a visit. Pop, goes the weasel. Returning to the Pontiac, Bob slid in a CD, and as he drove to return to Woodview, Phil Oakes' voice sang, I am the masculine American man. I kill, therefore I am.
Station 3. Annie got his gun.
Blunt force trauma, I headlined the newspaper as it slapped the stoop of Bob's door in the morning. Bob awoke to that distant slap, and before him, a booger flake fluttered in her nostril like a hummingbird's wing, the stink of her morning breath far too human and flawed. In the canine world, only small dogs can mimic such a monster. Small dogs, indeed, are capable of fishy breath. Not so big dogs, who at their worst may expirate the odor of stale oven bread. They were predictable this way. There would be no tragic chaos to them. Certainly Bob was particularly moved by and admired wolves for their gait and monogamy, but in his heart he knew himself best as a hybrid. Not a DAWG dog, but yes, a dog. A house pet with wolf blood. It took a special bitch to elicit his commitment. He'd found and delivered a few times, all to women of chub and red hair, but got bit at the throat nonetheless and assumed the word bitch too flattering for anything without canine creds. These he simply considered as ungenerous souls, spelled C-U-N-T-S, women who operated in direct impingement.
Direct impingement, a type of gas operation for a firearm that directs gas from a fired cartridge directly into the bolt carrier or slide assembly to cycle the action and expel the casing.
Provisions should be material, he thought, and he was neither a provision nor material. Her burger flapped in the stilted vibration of that hummingbird's wing till Bob was nearly nauseated. While Bob had dreams of assassination for phrases like, me time or my truth. He certainly felt no obligation to defile himself in conversation or continued study of a face that was only beautiful by the standard of mathematical symmetry. He silently extracted himself from the bed and plodded naked to the bathroom. There, sitting on the standard toilet, he let his imagination drift in its discovery of ancient faces within the patterns of the marble wall. On any given day, perhaps based on the firing of synapses or the level of reflected light, could one find an infinite materialization of faces in marble? Haunted faces, gargoyles, the wise and the soulful. Marble, like sedimentary rock, held greater truths than any man. And man, did Bob know it. He stepped over the morning paper to take his daily constitutional. As his wallabies met the tarmac of Sweet Dog Lane, Bob Sixthence for Amateur Urban Hides caught Helen Mayo observing him from behind a blind in an upstairs window. He stopped in his tracks and stared at the blind for one, then two, then three full minutes. Eventually, the blind was pushed aside. Helen Mayo chose to encounter Bob. They glared at one another. He, because the sun bounce, was glary. She, with suspicion and bitterness. Both of them oblivious to the sound of a helicopter falling in emergency reverse rotor auto-rotation. Suddenly, the helicopter fell full force from the sky, crashing through Helen's roof, obliterating Helen, and bursting into a terrible fireball. Bob considered his options. A futile rescue effort, or get off the X.
Get off the X. Moving off the line of force or away from crosshairs.
When the fire department would later arrive, Bob watched from his stoop as aviation investigators taped off the scene around Helen's house. Local police arrived. Power hoses turned black smoke into white, and Spurley's little Prius pulled up before Bob's house. Spurley parked and approached Bob. "Hi, Bob," Spurley said.
"Spurley,"
said Bob.
"Quite a little drama," said Spurley with an expression bordering ironic scorn.
"Bad optics?"
"Seems to be a lot of that around you these days," Spurley responded.
Back in Bob's living room, the two men returned to their established positions. Spurley launched in with,
"Here's the thing, Bob. The folks I worked for had asked me to pick a random male living in my own community. For an addition, focusing on an American man unknown to his neighborhood. This may sound a bit esoteric, but stay with me on it. We've all seen it in our childhood. An individualist archetype, that fella on the block nobody knows. Perhaps he's a loner, perhaps antisocial, or perhaps has a dark secret, like a sexual dungeon, that sort of thing."
"I don't have a sexual dungeon, Spurley."
No, I wasn't insinuating that, Bob. I'm not an archetype either, or whatever you said." "Relax, Bob. I know that, of course. All I'm saying is, I went ahead and asked a few questions in the neighborhood and local police, and there seemed to be only one fella continually drawing my attention, and that fella is the same fella whose timing, be it inconvenient or coincidental, had him walking his morning constitutional this morning, only to observe the very neighbor who had most often filed complaints with the police about him being obliterated by a rapidly descending helicopter." Bob nodded. "You spend a lot of time on your own, don't you, Bob? You got a gal?" Bob nodded. From the distance, he began to hear the circus music of his ex-wife's ice cream truck. "Where is she, Bob? Where's your gal?"
"I don't know, Spurley. I haven't seen her in a long time. I get messages from her sometimes, or pictures, you know. Will you excuse me, Spurley? I've got some things I gotta do."
"Like what, Bob?"
"Just stuff."
As he walked Spurley out, the music of the ice cream truck attenuated to amplitude. Bob moved back into his house, leaving Spurley on the stoop, listening through the door as Spurley went on his way. In his bedroom, Bob sat on the edge of his bed and opened the drawer of the bedside table. In the clutter of the drawer, he found a picture. It was of him and Annie. The only time the two of them had ever traveled together was when Bob had been hired by the state to orchestrate a pyrotechnic display from a barge off the Venezuelan island of La Isla Margarita. The picture was, along with Bob's passport and California driver's license, one of only three photographs he knew to exist of himself. It was of the two of them, he and Annie, the ocean, the palms, and the hammock they shared on a Wednesday afternoon. Annie's smile beaming. Bob's, forced as a mugshot, but warmed by the jeweled bit of banana that rested beneath his lower lip. He carefully replaced the photo at the bottom of the drawer in one corner, sliding some of the clutter over the top of it. From there he moved back to the closed toilet seat, sat on it, and let his eyes wander the marble like a map of human history, a metaphoric rock of recrystallized carbonate materials, the calcite or dolomite. He pulled the cell phone from his pocket and Googled Ennio Morricone's masterpiece, Gabriel's Oboe. As it came up, he pressed play and let the music make the marble and its faces of time dance before him. The oboe and strings develop the faces of primitive man. In the prelude to the climb rises a deformed face of Christ, bleeding into the Crusades. Gargoyles gasp and birth monkeys creep into lava lamp articulation. A piccolo flute solo calms Cretans and lepers arriving three at a time. The French horns, like conquered Nazis, in any color of marble do their eyes reflect in blue, while Plutarch's men of parallel lives barter bluster. And in the Requiem, Bob is born. The choral cascades and faces of fallen friends. In its conclusion, would Bob weep? And so he did, as the marble of mankind danced before him from the beginning of humankind to the creation of Annie's face. Hers, like kinetic energy-penetrating ammunition, ballistically blasting away the battle scars of Bobby's heart. The crocodile tears burst from his eyes into the magic whisper of Morricone's flute, until the entire form of Annie molded itself outward from the marble, dancing for him, then wiping his tears before being reabsorbed by the wall. Where had life gone? It's data on previous engagements.
Data on previous engagements, a.k.a. D-O-P-E, or dope. A process used by precision rifle shooters to log, track, and access information specific to his or her weapon's behavioral history and unique machining.
Bob was 55, and numbness dominated his day. As a creature adept at selective memory, he'd sometimes fill gaps by speaking to himself aloud.
Woodview, California has trees and birds. Woodview, California has treason birds. I am Bob Honey, surrounded by trees and birds. Surrounded by treason.
Treason to love, to creation, to art and authenticity. He stood, returned to the bedroom, flipped on his television. A former professional athlete was modeling underwear. A famous movie star was driving a marquee sedan above cliffs and sea. A game show host selling cell phones, and all so proud in their specimen standing and justification for their self-charity, cha-ching and bling. Branding is being born as the elderly drive us down. Bob stood between the ages, torn, broken, co-opted. A mercenary for marketing, in treason to thyself.
Station 4.